Philadelphia's soda tax has been in effect since the first of the year. Too soon to gauge its long-term effect, though a recently published paper called Regressive Sin Taxes points to variables that may determine its ultimate success or failure. Joining me is study co-author Benjamin Lockwood, assistant professor of business economics and public policy at Wharton. Professor Lockwood, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a definition. What's a sin tax?
So a sin tax is a tax on some good that that policymakers are concerned might have adverse consequences for the people consuming it. So health consequences or something like that, that people aren't taking into account when they make the decision. So it's important to emphasize, there are some things that have harmful health consequences like driving that we don't tax because we think people broadly take that into account when making their decisions. But for things like soda or cigarettes, we're concerned that the long-term health consequences might not be fully internalized when people decide how much to consume.
And that's part of the key. Driving, an accident happens in a moment. With cigarettes, alcohol, soda, these are long-term health effects we're talking about.
That's correct.
And so what is the price point when you bring in the term regressive? Is that trying to determine, in this case with Philadelphia, 1.5 cents per ounce, that price point whereby it will actually serve as a deterrent?
Yeah. So the concern here is that on the one hand, sin tax has this intended consequence of reducing consumption of a harmful good like soda. But on the other hand, there's a concern that taxes on these sorts of goods might fall more heavily on poorer consumers. And that's really what we mean when we talk about regressivity. So poorer consumers tend to consume soda, also cigarettes, at higher rates than richer consumers. And so the concern is that a tax on that sort of good might adversely affect the poor in particular. Now, the countervailing issue is that because the consumption initially has negative health consequences, then people who reduce their consumption the most in response to the tax actually get the resulting health benefits. So the real key concern here, the real key question, is whether people respond a lot to the tax, whether they reduce their consumption in response to the tax, or whether they go on consuming the same amount regardless.
Two thoughts come to mind. If you need a sugar fix, if the tax is on soda, why can't you just buy a candy bar? And number two, let's bring geography into play. If you live right across the City Avenue border, you just go into the suburbs and buy all the soda you want.
These are both great points. And this is unfortunately why it's still a little hard to tell exactly what the effects of this tax are going to be. So if the tax works as policymakers anticipate or as they intend, then the goal would be for a higher tax to result in people just consuming less sugary soda or maybe reducing their sugar consumption overall. On the other hand, you're right that if people substitute toward other sugary goods, things like candy bars or driving across the Ben Franklin Bridge and just buying their soda in Jersey, then that won't be as successful because you won't have actually reduced the adverse health consequences. And so if that turns out to be the case, that we see people sort of consuming the same amount of sugary beverages, but just by going to different areas to do so, then that actually is still informative for policymakers, but it says something about how these policies should be designed. For example, it might be more useful in that case to try to coordinate with other nearby locales when setting these kinds of taxes. On the other hand, if people basically always just buy their groceries at their nearby store and respond by consuming less soda, then that sort of cooperation might be less crucial.
I believe Mayor Kenney learned from other failed attempts to impose a soda tax whereby he wasn't focusing inordinately on the health benefits, but rather where those tax dollars would go, in this case, in part to expand pre-K. Though I'm wondering, what if that sin tax went for some sort of credit for, say, healthier drinks or juices?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. What's the right way to spend, or does it matter how you spend the revenues from this sort of tax? So another question we consider in our paper is whether you can offset the regressivity, which sort of falls most heavily on poorer consumers, whether you can offset that regressivity by targeting the revenues back toward those consumers, or as you say, toward consumers that are sort of switching to healthier consumption behaviors. And the answer that we get to ends up being a little bit technical, but I think the ultimate upshot is that if indeed it is helpful to target revenues toward things like pre-K spending. That's a great idea, but it probably doesn't depend on the existence of a sin tax in the first place. That makes sense to fund regardless.
Back to that 1.5 cents per ounce, could an argument be made that it would be more effective if it was 5 cents, 10 cents, a dollar an ounce? What's the right pitch point?
No, that is really the key question in all of this. And we are starting to see some very initial estimates of what the response is like to these taxes. But I think we really need more evidence over, which we will have over the next couple of years, as we see the response to these few cities that have started passing soda taxes. Once we see that, we'll have a better gauge of what the proper level of the tax is. So on the one hand, we do have the health benefits. On the other hand, we have these regressivity costs that tend to be larger if people don't respond a lot to the tax. If they do respond and reduce their consumption, then those regressivity costs aren't as much a concern. And so we'll really see when by looking at how people respond and reduce their consumption in the face of these taxes, we'll see what the optimal size of that tax is. Now, I can say that based on the very early estimates that we've seen so far, it seems reasonable to guess that the middling estimates probably entail a tax somewhere around the size that Philadelphia or Boulder at 2 cents an ounce, that somewhere around the size of those taxes, maybe even a little larger than those taxes. But again, I can't say for sure until we have some better estimates that come out over the next year or two.
You go to your local corner shop and you're thirsty and you buy a soda. It's a little different than going to the supermarket and intending to buy a six-pack, let alone a case. That's where you really see that price point.
That's true. You may be more sensitive to the existence of the tax when you're making these large decisions in bulk and thinking about how to trade off those decisions against other things that you're also buying at the grocery store. And also, in a number of cases around Philadelphia, grocers have tried to make it really clear that the tax is now in place by adding a line item on receipts saying that that tax exists. So it may be a little bit more salient that the tax is in place when you're at those sorts of institutions.
Talk about naysayers who say this is yet more evidence of a nanny state. And of course, they use that term as a pejorative.
Right. So this is why it comes back to this key question about whether people are taking into account the negative consequences of soda consumption, of sugary beverages, when they're making the decision. So I, like many economists, are very opposed to taxes that sort of get in the way or impose regulation when people are making sensible decisions for themselves. On the other hand, there's a growing body of behavioral economics literature that suggests people tend to overweigh the costs or benefits of something that happens right up front and then underweigh the costs or benefits that happen a long time in the future. And that can help make sense of everything from why you exercise less than you might intend to why you save too little for retirement. And so now that we have that big body of behavioral evidence, you can make a similar argument for things like soda taxes. So there's really a strong amount of evidence suggesting that people might be making these kinds of systematic mistakes. And in that case, the potential is there to actually help them and help their health outcomes by trying to correct those things that we know, those kinds of psychological biases that we know many of ourselves are subject to.
Interestingly, the Philadelphia tax also applies to diet soda. Were there health implications also being concerned about what additives are used in those drinks?
So I actually think that part of the motivation for the tax on diet soda had to do with the fact that diet soda is not consumed as much by poorer consumers as it is by richer consumers. So it was thought to be a way of partially offsetting the regressivity of taxing sugary soda itself. Unfortunately, again, from the economics perspective, thinking about helping people correct their health mistakes, the key policy goal is really to get people to stop consuming the thing that is harmful health-wise. So the argument then is really stronger to apply the tax specifically to sugary beverages and let people substitute away to diet sodas and the like if that's what they'd rather switch to.
Professor, I'm going to open a bottle of sugar-free seltzer here and toast your efforts. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Benjamin Lockwood, Assistant Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy at Wharton.